America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. It's a dirty job, but someone has to do it. And in this podcast, we're not referring to just any dirty job, for which there are plenty. This is not the stuff that Mike Rowe explores. We're talking about uncomfortable and ethically challenging jobs that we put people in. They do the work for our society, and we feel it's necessary, and yet we'd rather keep it all out of sight and discuss as little as possible. In a moment, you'll hear what we're talking about, and it will all click in. That's today on America Trends.
With me on America Trends is Eyal Press, and he's written a book called Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. And Eyal, I'll be honest, I didn't quite understand at the beginning exactly what you were going to be pursuing in this book. I know there are many dirty jobs in America. You and I think about them and say, boy, somebody is willing to do that, and thank goodness they are, because it's not something I would want to do. But then you get down another layer, and you go into the ethical concerns about work and some of the responsibilities we give to people that we keep out of sight so that we, those of us who have more quote-unquote respectable jobs, don't have to think about what's being done in our name. And you started the book just to give that emphasis with a story relative to Nazi Germany. And at first it was like, where is he headed here? But then I understood.
Right. Well, let me pull back and explain a little bit for those who are confused. It is a book about what I would call the moral division of labor. We're very familiar with the idea of the division of labor. We're also, because of the pandemic, I think, a very heightened state of awareness about the fact that some people do desk jobs that they can do from home, and other people have to physically leave their homes. And those latter workers were called essential workers during the pandemic, people like, you know, delivery drivers and so forth. But my book is about the moral division of labor, which I think gets us to think about moral inequality. But as you said, I start with an essay, actually, that was written over 50 years ago by a sociologist named Everett Hughes. And the essay was titled Good People and Dirty Work. And it was based on time that Hughes spent in post-war Germany. He was actually teaching there in Frankfurt. And he talked to folks he'd known before World War II, who he categorized as the good people. These were cosmopolitan intellectuals. These were, you know, journalists and architects and teachers. And he had the gumption to bring up, you know, and to ask them about what had happened during the war and how they sort of made sense of the Nazi era, which they had just lived through. But the people Hughes spoke to said to him, you know, on the one hand, you know, we're ashamed of this. We feel terrible about it. It was awful. It was, you know, you have to understand there was no room for dissent. This was a totalitarian environment and, you know, and so on, which is exactly what you'd expect good people to say. But then they went on to say, but, you know, the Jews, they were a problem. You know, they were taking all the good jobs here, and, you know, they, you know, were in, gathered in these ghettos, and something had to be done to settle this problem. And Hughes kept kind of hearing this from folks, and out of this, he formulates this theory that he writes up into this essay. And what he basically says is that although we would like to think of the dirty work in Nazi Germany, the dirty work of rounding up, you know, the impure races, that the Jews and other targets, as a sort of rogue operation, in fact, the dirty workers were acting as agents of the rest of society. They were taking care of a problem that many people sort of wrote off and didn't want to hear too much about. And it's not as though the good people Hughes talked to, we'll put that in quotes, approved of what the Nazis did, but they were sort of indifferent enough because they saw, as he put it, the Jews as a problem. And what to me is so interesting about that essay is not what it says about Nazi Germany, but what it says later, which Hughes, you know, sort of, he didn't write this essay to add to the literature on Nazism. He said, you know, this dynamic exists in every society. There is dirty work. There are these sort of morally compromised, morally troubling activities that go on. And then a lot of members of society don't want to hear about them. They don't ask too many questions. And what kind of dirty work goes on in our society? Well, that's the point of departure for my book.
Exactly. You talk about this unconscious mandate that a society gives. And, you know, I think it even goes beyond. I know in the book you talk about the drone operators. And there they are at Fort Lauderdale, whatever it may be. And they're using this joystick to direct where these lethal weapons are going to be applied halfway across the world. When I think about it, oftentimes I think about our military. Now, of course, they're all volunteers. Very few of us, when we were in Afghanistan for the last 10, 12 years, gave it just any thought of what was going on over there in our name and whether there were tragedies befalling civilians, whatever it might be. We gave it no thought. And frankly, even our own Congress basically authorized force and never really looked back on it for 20 years.
Absolutely. And that's why I did include the example of America's never-ending wars in the book. And I did look specifically at people in the drone program. But I should say, you know, to go back to this idea, if we think about dirty work as something that has an unconscious mandate, and I do think it does, and I think that's a really powerful and important sort of phrase in that Hughes essay that kept coming up for me as I was researching all of this and talking to workers. But if we think about it, that unconscious mandate is actually much more important in a democratic society than it is in a totalitarian country like Nazi Germany or Stalinist Russia. Because in those latter countries, you know, the government does what it's going to do, and it sort of doesn't care what, you know, the population, what citizens say and think. But here in this country, we have some say over what is done in our name, both in terms of how the wars are arranged, you know, who fights in them, whether they are fought, and at least ostensibly, and of course, one could say, well, Congress has abdicated its responsibility and people have stopped paying attention, and all of that is true, but I think we then have to ask, well, why is that? And I think it has a lot to do with how we can, in effect, delegate this out to what I call in the book the other 1%.
Hey, Al, you're talking about the other 1%. Who are these? Are they the voiceless? Are they ostensibly relegated, assigned, or volunteering to do the dirty work for our society?
Yeah, I mean, I use that term to refer to the 1%, as I was saying, the 1% of people in America who have actually served in the military since we launched these forever wars, which was 20 years ago. To me, what's so striking about that is I think a lot of people think, well, we have a volunteer army, we don't have a draft, and what that means is that only the folks who want to enlist in the military actually do so. So that seems very fair. But then when you look at it more closely, and I do in the book, what we find is that people who enter the military are disproportionately from lower income and working class communities in this country. And they are the ones who bear the burden of this fighting, not the sons and daughters of Wall Street, tycoons, or for that matter, senators. It's people in places where maybe there wouldn't otherwise be an opportunity to travel or get a job or get an education. And so effectively, I suggest, we have sort of offloaded war making to people who operate under the pressure of economic, you know, necessity. That's a phrase that the philosopher Michael Sandel has used. But, you know, we basically hire certain people in society to fight wars. And I think that same paradigm applies to a lot of the other dirty work I look at.
Let me talk about the slaughterhouses, because you talk about those. And clearly, most of us don't want to know how inhumane a lot of the farming practices are as it relates to animals. But we read about it from time to time. We see a documentary. We say that's horrible. And then the next day, we're at a restaurant eating the fruits of that activity. And I'm wondering, when you look at that, what is that saying? I mean, the individual who does that sees that there is something that is being utilized, and in fact, the good people of society are partaking in the fruits of their labor. And do they just say to themselves, well, it can't be morally wrong or unethical because, look, everybody is part of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, and I have to say I would include myself in the category of people who kind of want to push the ugliness and the exploitation out of mind. And when I say the ugliness and exploitation, I mean not just in terms of the animals, but also in terms of how the workers are treated. Because, you know, I talked about the 1% we hire, or the less fortunate people we hire to do unpleasant tasks. And in slaughterhouses, those tasks tend to be allotted to immigrants, often to undocumented immigrants, who are often exploited and treated, you know, in ways that assault their dignity. The women I met who worked in a poultry slaughterhouse had been denied bathroom breaks because the line speeds were such that you had to keep working. And if they stopped working, even for a little bit, to go to the bathroom, they would get reprimanded. Now, most of us would not approve of that if we saw it in front of our eyes, and we don't want to connect to the food we eat. But there is a connection, in the sense that writers like Michael Pollan and many others have said, the point that the way the industrial food system in our country is structured and organized is that we hide the brutality of it, and we also hide the cost. The costs to others, or to the environment, to the animals, and to the workers, so that the meat itself, the food, remains cheap. And that cheapness comes at a price to others. So I do think that we are all connected to this in different ways, and the importance of thinking about it is a collective one.
Are you surprised that there are so many of the respectable class who really now are looking and saying, we don't want any immigrants in America, when in fact, as you suggest, people of color, often women in certain cases, but immigrants, we do assign them some of these tasks, and they take them on willingly because they want a leg up on the ladder of success in America?
Yeah, I'm not surprised, because I think that, as I trace in the book, it's nothing new. I mean, actually, what was really interesting, the slaughterhouse I looked at, the poultry slaughterhouse, happened to be in Texas. And I did some reading and research about farm workers in Texas, you know, back in the late 19th and early 20th century. And what I discovered was that a lot of the workers were, you know, Mexican immigrants, and they were relied on to work for very low wages as farmhands, and they were also seen as dirty at the same time. People you shouldn't associate with, people who were somehow lesser than the others. So I don't think it's entirely new, this dynamic where on the one hand you have a dependency, that society sort of needs someone to do this very unpleasant work. At the same time, the people who are doing it become ridiculed and targeted with stereotypes. And I do think that sort of, it doesn't make sense at a rational level, but I think at an emotional and a gut level, it does make sense.
During the pandemic, when I was out and about, and again, these people who really had no choice about staying home or not, who were really manning the front lines for so many of us, whether it was in a grocery store, whether it was wherever it might be, where they had to interact and put themselves in harm's way. And of course, within the hospitals, we know how excessive that burden has been. But what did that tell you as somebody researching this topic of what is now called essential work? Yet in many ways, this essential work is work we don't want to know a whole lot about, or we wouldn't want to put ourselves in that situation given the opportunity to avoid it.
It was really fascinating, to be honest, to be sort of writing this book and actually finishing the book as the pandemic was happening, because you're right, this conversation about essential workers sort of came up all of a sudden. What also came up was the reality that there's a division of labor in America, right? There are the folks who have the privilege to work at their desks and shelter in place, and then you had other people who are risking their lives and often getting sick from COVID, delivering food for others, driving trucks, you know, that needed to be driven. So it was this sort of, you know, playing out of this inequality. What I kept thinking about was that there's a piece of this we're not talking about. We are talking about, you know, some workers being more exposed to physical risks, but we're not talking about the psychic and emotional and moral burdens that people lower on the social ladder often carry when they carry out society's dirty work. So, you know, what I mean by that is, you know, for folks working in prisons, you have, you know, high rates of suicide, of divorce, of alcoholism, of stress. You have in the drone program high rates of burnout. I use the term moral injury that is a sort of central term in the book. We don't really talk about this when we talk about inequality, but we should talk about it, because inequality isn't just about who gets more money and who gets less. It's also about who suffers those burdens more and who doesn't. Right? Who ends up feeling devalued, stigmatized, morally injured, and who does not?
And how does that whole process perpetuate itself? By that I mean those who generally can get a college education, can get on a good track. They might have had some opportunities when they were growing up. Others who grew up in a family where the work was of this nature, where perhaps the family was more itinerant, didn't really have roots, or perhaps were forced to do things just to make a living and be able to support their family. How much does this perpetuate itself in our society?
I think it perpetuates itself a lot. And I think that one of the reasons it perpetuates itself is that we have such an unequal society. And, you know, I don't just mean by that, you know, the 1% or the 0.1%, the billionaires. I also mean, you know, the top 10%, people in, you know, well-paying professions and white-collar or managerial positions who really not only don't do the dirty work in society, but don't even see it, right? It's sort of one of the themes in the book is that all this work is sort of done in these remote, poorer areas of the country. So you don't actually really see very often into, you don't pass the industrial slaughterhouse on your way home from work if you live in a posh suburb and work, you know, as a consultant and make a six-figure salary. And so I think that as we become a more and more unequal society, the inequality has shaped the way that dirty work is allocated and organized.
When I think about it, I'm thinking about how many dirty jobs there are, or how many jobs are out of sight that we choose not to see. I knew you point to the psychiatric wards and jails and prisons. Now, there we used to institutionalize a lot of people. Then we went to a different community-based service care model, and that has left a lot of people really in unstructured environments or not necessarily getting the treatment that they need because we don't fund it adequately. And then they end up being, you know, jailed for a mental illness. And this is going on all the time. Now, I'm just wondering again, you know, if in fact our society thinks that this is what we, you know, need to do to keep other people safe, is this something that, again, a guard or somebody who's in one of these institutions really can, in their own minds, justify because something society says we need to be doing? They don't sit there and analyze,
well, really, how did it get to this point where I'm in this jail with a mentally ill person who probably doesn't belong here, but I had nothing to do with that, and if this is what society says I need to be doing, then this is not dirty work. This might even be noble on the part of the individual doing it.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I would say, and I do say actually in the book, that I think we send the custodians of our jails and prisons very mixed messages as a society. On the one hand, when stories appear in the newspaper about incarcerated people who have been abused or mistreated, particularly if they're very vulnerable and maybe had a mental illness, as many do have, because we rely on jails and prisons to warehouse so many people with mental illnesses. But when that story appears and it's on the nightly news or the local news, I think, you know, a lot of people are sort of quick to say, oh, look at that, you know, those guards, they did this brutal thing, what a terrible thing. But at the same time, as a society, we have put the custodians of jails and prisons in charge, effectively, of a very, you know, hundreds of thousands, not thousands, hundreds of thousands of people with severe mental illnesses who are behind bars and who cycle through these carceral institutions. And what do we really expect will happen there, right? Do we really expect they'll get proper care and treatment and rehabilitation, particularly when it's very poorly funded? You know, so you can understand why the folks who work in those institutions are thinking, wait a minute, you really want us to treat these people humanely? No, you don't. What you really want is to be rid of this problem and to just have nobody ask any questions, and certainly not to you. And that's what I kept hearing from, you know, prison guards and also mental health aides in prisons when I spoke to them. And I think they have a point.
The book is called Dirty Work: Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. AL Press is with us, the author. And I've got to ask you about what we've seen recently on the news, and that relates to the Border Patrol and the way they have been dealing in this recent period with Haitian refugees. And this is a tough job. And if, in fact, the policy that undergirds these jobs is confused, is duplicitous, extends some very bad practices over from one administration to another, or it's just so overwhelming that we as a society can't get our arms around it. And at the same time, we've got a Congress complicit because they will never tackle immigration reform for various political reasons. So the person ending up at the end of the barrel of the gun, the Border Patrol, what do you say about their job and the way perhaps we have put them in this dirty line of business?
What I just said about prison guards, I think a lot of that applies to Border Patrol agents. And again, I don't want to overgeneralize. There certainly are a lot of people who protest and, you know, migrant rights activists who feel, you know, we need a new system. We need a more humane system. You know, they would be the first to say, you know, this is wrong and we shouldn't, we need structural reform. And that's fair enough. But I do think that once again, society sort of sends these mixed signals. You know, during the Trump era, you heard a lot of talk about how the Border Patrol and agencies like ICE were, you know, rogue agencies, you know, in effect that they carried out this violence and this brutal treatment of migrants almost kind of independent of society. There was no check on them. And the brutality was certainly real. But what I question is how rogue it was, because after all, deporting people en masse and actually even detaining children in these facilities did not begin with Donald Trump. As I point out in the book and talk about, you know, some of this, there were harsh, very harsh border policies that can be traced back to the Clinton administration and that actually existed under Obama as well. And there was a lot less outrage about that. And again, I think that's because there's a very mixed set of attitudes in the public. And what ends up happening is these different signals are sent to the Border Patrol. You know, on the one hand, you know, no, don't be brutal, don't be cruel, don't do these terrible things. On the other hand, you know, secure the border and militarize it and make sure that people don't come in who shouldn't be here. And so I do think there is an aspect of this that kind of mirrors and parallels that kind of, you know, two conflicting messages that I mentioned in regard to prison guards.
I'm thinking about another prison guard. I was at the dog park where I spent a lot of my time with my newly arrived dog about a year ago. And I meet some fascinating people there, I've got to tell you. And a gentleman that I met, he had a cap on. It said Guantanamo. And I said, gee, that's not a real tourist spot. He said, no, I was a guard. And I'm really wondering, because one of the things you say is, the burden of dirtying one's hands and the benefit of having a clean conscience are increasingly functions of privilege, capacity, and distance ourselves from where the dirty work is performed. And that is a classic example. We offshored it. Nobody really knew or even knows to this day what went on in our name. Of course, we know there have been black sites around the world where our dirty work has been done. Of course, Guantanamo itself, and nobody has seemed able to close it. So what is that a metaphor for?
Yeah, I think that captures it really well. And I should say that when I talk about, you know, the public, the sort of unconscious mandate, which we began talking about, we talked about Everett Hughes, I want to be very clear about one thing. I don't mean by that people who think of themselves as good and decent explicitly assent to these things, right? If you show someone the pictures at Abu Ghraib, if you tell someone about the abuses that I wrote about in the prison in Florida in my book that are just extremely, you know, they're extreme abuses, very few people are going to say, oh, I approve of that, right? They don't approve of it. Most people don't. It's not about the explicit assent. It's about the, you know, passive acquiescence, the not wanting to hear about it. The, on the one hand, you know, saying, oh, no, I totally disapprove of that. And on the other hand, kind of wanting to switch the subject when it comes up or not dwell on it or not actually think about how, you know, the choices we make, including how we vote, how we maybe don't vote, how these things end up, you know, creating some of these cruel and practices and dirty jobs. So that's the point. The point is that it's not about, you know, rah-rah, we're for all of this. It's that there's a lot of, you know, Everett Hughes, again, he talked about passive Democrats, people who had, you know, all the right attitudes but never really did much and didn't really want to hear about it. And that's the dynamic I'm trying to talk about.
And you define dirty work in this book, again, just to make certain everybody understands, work that causes substantial harm either to other people or to animals or the environment. Number two, it entails doing something good people, respectable members, see as dirty and morally compromised, even if they're unwilling really to put a halt to it or be effective in trying to. And third, it's work injurious to people who do it, leading them to feel devalued and stigmatized. And I just want people to really understand that this is a whole new level. It's not the guy cleaning out the bathrooms at Yankee Stadium that we're talking about here. It's a whole different thing. And you do call it America's Untouchables. Now, in a society like ours, thinking of ourselves as democratic, modern, sophisticated, would you imagine that there's less of this work going forward, or is there even as much or more than we might imagine from the past?
I think it's changed form, but I don't think that advancing in modernity necessarily means we have less dirty work of just the kind you described. And in fact, one of the central ideas in the book that I don't get to talk about enough, but I think it's very, very crucial to the book, is this idea of what constitutes civilization. And I'm not the one who came up with the idea, but I cite this fascinating book by Norbert Elias, and he was a sociologist who wrote about how as civilization advanced, what happened is disturbing events were pushed behind the scenes of social life. And in effect, they were hidden. And he actually talks about this mostly in regard to table manners, things like blowing your nose or defecating, all kinds of things that you know, a civilized person would never do that in the public. It has to be hidden. It has to be privatized. It has to be, you know, discreet. But all kinds of implicit in his analysis, in this idea, is that this also could apply to something like, you know, punishment, the system of punishment in a society. So we don't flog, right? Because that's, we don't flog criminals, and we don't hang people on the scaffold, because that's what barbaric societies did. But we do sequester them in isolation cells behind the walls of jails and prisons. And that would be an example of, you know, what he would have called a civilized punishment. Of course, that's in air quotes. It's not actually less violent, right? Appears to be. And so I think that if we think about getting more modern that way, we come to realize that it doesn't necessarily mean we are having less, you know, exploitation, violence, and cruelty. It just means we see less of it, and it takes more discreet forms. And I think we need to be aware of that in order to have a more sense of the risks that we have as a society to perpetuate, you know, immoral and unethical conduct.
And this goes and complements some of the work that Professor Moyne has been doing at Yale, where he's written a book, and we posted his podcast recently called Humane, talking about the fact that we've decided not to worry about ending war. We're just going to make it more humane, antiseptic, and over the horizon. And I think the premise of his book and yours go hand in hand. I really do.
That's a great example of the same idea, yeah.
Eyal Press, I cannot thank you enough for being with us. The book is called Dirty Work, and it's really worth picking up. It really is. Thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you so much for having me on. I enjoyed the conversation.